altered AI.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Nandy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I think Meta is a good name. Meta. Facebook is no more.
My Shiro doesn't always wear a cape, but she always has time for a hug, a smile, for going the extra mile. My Shiro stretches every dollar, puts in long hours, puts others first. But now it's your time, Mom. When you're ready to retire, we want you to be able to enjoy it. Get free tips to help boost your retirement savings now at aceretirement.org.
A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Are you a Dearborn resident 60 years or older? Did you know that you can take classes at Henry Ford College tuition free? Would you like to improve your computer skills, become an actor, an artist, or an auto mechanic, or enjoy one of 100 other classes? You could even find yourself on the radio like I did, and I did it tuition free at Henry Ford College. For a complete information and a list of classes, please visit our website at hfcc.edu.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, winner of the Spirit of College Radio Award, featuring local and independent artists.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the WHFR Journal. My name's Alan Mazurek. I'm so pleased to be with you and with Susan McGraw as well for another hour of conversation and discussion of things going on, important things going on in our community. Oh, let's see, Susan. We had our first spell of really, really cold weather. Not as cold as it's going to get, but typically qualifies as cold weather. And that, as always, means that seasons are changing. We obviously head into Thanksgiving week and the holiday season, and always look for a lot of opportunities, especially when it comes to Thanksgiving, for giving back. And we want to bring up the subject of volunteerism on our program today, but also put a little bit of a spotlight on people who may need to be the benefits of some of that volunteerism as well. So why don't we just jump right in? Clock's ticking. We've only got an hour for the show today. So let's see what we've got coming up. How about that?
Thank you, Alan. I look forward to this. So excited to share our airwaves with so many of the important community services that the city of Dearborn is participating in. One of those at the forefront is the Meals on Wheels program. Probably this is a term that is familiar to most people, but if you've never really had the chance to really dig in and see exactly what Meals on Wheels does, who they support, how easy it is to get involved as a volunteer, and also how to sign up if you or a family member are in need of the services. Well, those are just some of the topics we're going to talk about today. And we are grateful that the city of Dearborn has the passionate and wonderful people in place that help make these services so successful. We're going to talk about some other things related to other food distribution. We're going to talk about vaccines availability for boosters and so on here in the community. But we really wanted to bring in the expert who has made it a passion of hers to make sure that these services are being run properly. And that is Cecilia Pilon, who is very active through the senior services in the city of Dearborn and so much more. I can't even begin to talk about how excited I am to have Cece, as we know and love her and call her, here with us today. So Cece, it's a pleasure to have you on the WHFR Journal. Thank you for the service that you provide for this community. And we're very happy to have you here. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Terrific. When we talk Meals on Wheels, it's kind of like, I think, an expectation that we know that it's that organization that's going on in some communities and somebody's kind of taking care of it. But we don't, it's all kind of all we have to know, you know, unless we need to be a benefit of it, and then it becomes a whole different thing. So just in that first pass, for people that think they know what Meals on Wheels is and kind of have the general gist of it, particularly with these holidays coming, as Alan mentioned, tell us about your philosophy as it relates to Meals on Wheels in general, and how the city of Dearborn is working to make this program functional and effective for its citizens.
Well, we're very fortunate because the city of Dearborn actually hires someone, and that person is me for now anyway, to we're responsible. I'm responsible for the volunteers that deliver the Meals on Wheels. Also, I do the charts for them, the addresses, find out the people that have they would wish to have the Meals on Wheels. And well, it's changed a little bit, so I'm kind of going off a little bit because the COVID has thrown us off a little. They're now using tablets. The volunteers are using tablets with all the addresses on there. But we get phone calls here in my office asking for people to that want to go on Meals on Wheels. It can be a family member, say for maybe a mother or father, an aunt or an uncle, and we direct them to Wayne County. We give them a phone number to direct them to the county so that they can sign up for the Meals on Wheels. And the meals are right now are only being delivered twice a week, on Mondays and Thursdays, due to the COVID. And that's they are frozen meals right now also. We're hoping by next year, early next year, to go back to 5 days a week and the hot meals. But right now they are frozen. They are getting meals for every day of the week. However, between Monday and Thursday, they deliver and make sure that the clients have a meal for every day. So that's happening.
So Cece, I was just going to say, I'm so glad you bring that up because, you know, it's like every interview that Susan and I do, we feel like a broken record. How has COVID affected, you know, basically everything we talk about in our day-to-day lives? And that's that it means two different things, I would imagine. One in terms of how the volunteers operate, but also maybe some of the isolation that the people who are receiving those meals also feel. You know, I mean, and obviously the service has been around and they've gotten their meals previously because they're in some cases not able to get out and go out and go shopping and get food for themselves. But then you add the COVID aspect onto it. It's got to have been a very interesting year. And, you know, sort of what it's been like both for the recipients and for the volunteers.
Oh, yeah. It has changed quite a bit. You know, like I say, I'm hoping that we'll be going back and in a new year to the older system, which people enjoyed more when the food wasn't frozen. But because of the COVID, they are getting frozen meals. And like I say, they would appreciate going back to the hot meals, but it just hasn't been, they haven't been able to do that yet. We have 50 to 60 volunteers that I've been using. Some have been I've been using more through the COVID than others because of the only 2 days a week delivery instead of 5 days a week. I do have several volunteers and substitutes, and the city of Dearborn has been very supportive about volunteers. The volunteers have been great. I can't thank them enough. And I know that the people that we have that go out and do this type of work, they feel rewarded too, seeing the people, because the people that receive these meals are very happy to see somebody else, especially since this COVID. I mean, sometimes that's the only person they were seeing for weeks, months, you know. And unfortunately, we lost some of our people that were clients that were receiving the meals. We lost some to the COVID and others, you know, just other medical reasons. But I think we've done very well. I think Meals on Wheels has done very well through this whole thing. All the volunteers have been great. I do want to say that we do need more volunteers, because when I start back up, or we start back up with the five-day delivery, I will need more people. And for anybody to get in that position to be a volunteer, they have to fill out an application. And the city of Dearborn requires that I do a police record check on every volunteer. We deliver out of Kennedy Plaza, and we deliver out of Sisson Manor. So there's about seven routes, I'm sorry, at Kennedy. And there's, I think, about 12 at Sisson Manor where they deliver out of. And those route sheets are being used by the drivers with all the addresses. But they are learning to go to tablets now. That's something new that just started.
Got it. I know one of the things, if I can just interrupt for a sec, Cece, when it comes to people and their decision of whether to volunteer or not volunteer, oftentimes it's based on how much time of a commitment do I have to give. You know, if I don't have a lot of time to be able to donate, you know, multiple days a week, for example, maybe I can do once a week or once a month or special occasions, you know, holidays or whatever. What I've always understood about the Meals on Wheels program is that it really is kind of a few hours of your time a month or a couple hours a week, or it's really kind of whatever people can do, and you will sort of match what they're able to contribute by way of time and support to the needs that you've got.
They can tell me, like when they call in and I talk with them and talk about the application, usually ask them, or tell them actually that they're going to want to start at 9:30 in the morning approximately to pick up the food. And they're usually done between an hour to an hour and a half. And as you get close, if a driver gets closer to knowing the route that they're going to have, of course it becomes faster. The drivers do not have to volunteer every day for every day. I do have volunteers that volunteer more than once a week. That's their choice. But they do not have to. If there's some people that just want to be substitute drivers, and I use them quite frequently also. I have a list of substitute drivers, but you are not required to do more than once a week, or if, like I say, if you choose, you can just be a substitute driver.
All right. So I know that there's lots more to talk about as well. But so, for instance, let's, you know, just to sort of wrap up the Meals on Wheels side of things for people who might be interested in volunteering. And certainly, you know, it, again, when we talk about the last year and a half or so, it's great that you've had such a reliable stable of volunteers to be able to deliver the meals. For those who might be interested, and for those who either themselves need meal services or know somebody who might need meal services, what sort of that next step is?
Hey, if you wish to be a volunteer, then you can call me direct at 943-2009. And I would talk with the person that wants to be the volunteer and give them information about it. But like I say, they would have to fill it out an application, and then I send a report over to the police department asking them to verify that their driving record and their other record is all okay. And then I get an okay back. I've not had any problems with that at all. People want to sign up for Meals on Wheels, they would call the county direct. And that number is area code 734-326-5202. And a county representative would speak with them, and then they would take their information. That would be sent in to the site managers, and they would let me know, and I would make up my route sheets.
Absolutely. And food insecurity, obviously, is a problem that has been around, obviously, and it exists in every community. It exists in Dearborn, Inkster, everywhere in Wayne County that you've mentioned. It is a tremendous issue, and certainly one in the past year and a half or so, especially, you know, as we talk about, you know, the COVID world. Is it, as we head into this holiday season, is it different than last holiday season? And I know we're going to talk about vaccines and boosters and stuff like that. Has it changed this year compared to a year ago?
Oh, definitely. Well, for one thing, we used to have turkeys. That's been happening this year at all. That was not actually through Samaritas. There were some other organizations that would give us coupons and we'd send, pass them out and send people to the location to pick up the turkeys. But that's not happening. Like I say, our food count has gone substantially down now since we're operating more without the COVID bothering us. We're not delivering to the buildings anymore. Everybody has to come in here to pick up the food. I know that was a convenience back then, delivering the food, and it was necessary because there were some people that could not get out of their housing apartments. But as things got better, people could go to the grocery store, and so our numbers have gone down as far as passing out food. I suspect that I'll probably be delivering, having food passed out in December down to about 100. My normal numbers were about 120 before the COVID.
Well, Cece, and that's, I find that interesting because, in a sense, your numbers are going down, but in the broader sense, that almost seems like a good thing, right? I know that the service is there for people, but if people are able to get out and they've been vaccinated, that maybe that is a sense of progress. Would that be a fair enough assessment?
I would say that, and you know, we're not going to turn anybody away if they come in for food. The leftover food that I have, it usually goes to a church pantry. There's two of them that we usually alternate with. But I always keep food here in our pantry. I have a small pantry made up. In fact, during the COVID, I had people that came in and brought food from Kroger's or other stores to put in our pantry. I've been using some of that. I will not turn anybody away if they come in for food. If they can't make it on that Monday, we do ask that they do try to come in when our distribution date is. But if someone just walked in off the street and said, I need food, we certainly wouldn't turn them away.
Well, your service is, I'm certain, appreciated, Cece. And as we talk about other things that are going on through our community here in Dearborn, we just have to recognize that it takes more than one person to execute these different things. And you keep using the word volunteers, so we don't want to underestimate the power of what a few hours that somebody can contribute actually makes to the success of these programs. The one word that I don't want to, I'm hoping we won't have to hear forever, but I suspect we will, at least for the foreseeable future, is the word COVID. I can't wait until the day when we don't have to keep hearing and saying COVID, but it's among us. We know that it's a thing, and a very profound and, you know, certainly impactful. There are options in through the city of Dearborn for people to get vaccines and also boosters, which is the thing now. So tell us a little bit about how that works and how can we learn more?
The vaccines are going on right now. They're that's being handled by Wayne County. They are using our facility, two of our rooms down the hall. And that is between 12 p.m. until 7 p.m. days a week. And they have all of the vaccines, the Pfizer, the Moderna, the Johnson & Johnson. So even if you didn't have your vaccine yet, you could come in and get that vaccine. Or if you're ready for your booster, you can come in and just get the booster shot.
Great.
And that we've been seeing quite a number coming in. Yeah. Like I say, we're not in charge of that. The city of Dearborn is not running that. It's Wayne County, but they are using our facility.
Great. If we wanted to have one sort of central number for people to learn a little bit more about this, or at least be directed to somebody that can give specific hours and requirements, I know you need to bring your vaccine card and your insurance card, your license, you know, ID, whatever, for people that need to know these very specific things. What would be sort of a main number for all of the things we're talking about today, CC, to, you know, if we have to take away just one, we can remember just one or jot it down, which, what number would that be for additional support for all these different programs?
The best number would be the area code 313-943-2412. Again, normally, you know, even though the vaccine, we're not involved in it that much and they're using our facility, we have to know what time and so we can answer people's questions about what we have available and what hours. So that would be the number to call.
Okay, 313-943-2412. 2412. Thank you. We are hopeful that listeners might feel the love and the enthusiasm that you do in caring for our seniors and caring for our population here in this community and surrounding communities, and maybe thinking about how we can fit in a few hours a week or a month to do some of these things. I know we were doing Meals on Wheels for years through Dearborn, actually, but we only did certain holidays. That was sort of a special holiday tradition that my family did. And I miss that, actually. I look forward to diving back in, because there's just nothing like the feeling of connecting with someone in a very human basis and saying, hi, we've got this for you. We're here for you. We just want to say hello and hope you're doing well. And like you said in the beginning of our discussion today about something as simple as just a physical greeting from someone that hasn't been looked in on for days, weeks, or even, you know, months, etc., with the COVID, what a wonderful feeling for everybody involved. So you can't underestimate that feel-good power of being a volunteer, can you, Cece?
Oh, no. I was a volunteer for about 5 years, and it's very rewarding. Of course, you get attached to the people, and they get attached to you, but it's very rewarding just to even see that they're happy to see you. And you become happy to see them. You look forward to seeing them. You develop friendships too with them. It's hard not to do. So you do. It's very rewarding. And I think everybody that you would talk to, that the volunteer, would agree with that. And I'm very thankful that we have such great volunteers. Very grateful.
Well, thank you, Cece. And obviously, the number for people who want to get involved, 313-943-2412 is one of the numbers for people who need to sign up for Meals on Wheels, which is one of the other things we talked about, 734-326-5202, and that's through Wayne County, and that eventually works its way to your desk as well. So as we head into Thanksgiving week, and obviously the challenging year that it has been to keep this ship up and running and on course, yeah, what is it that you're thankful for or hopeful for this coming year?
Well, I think we're all hopeful that this COVID is going to be gone and gone for good. I mean, definitely, and that we can all enjoy the holidays with our families and look forward to the new year, definitely. And that's what I'm looking forward to, the being with family, being with friends, and just seeing this COVID gone.
And for those in our community who don't have that opportunity, we are so grateful that you have their backs in terms of coordinating all of the services that the city of Dearborn can provide for members of the community. Again, just to go back to the Meals on Wheels thing, even here in my community, I'm well aware of seeing people coming by a couple times a week to, you know, houses on my block. And this probably happens on every block in every community all around Metro Detroit and around the country as well. So it's a tremendous service, and it's just been great to talk to you about it.
Yeah, and we there's a lot of services here at the center. There's liquid nutrition. We do a telecare that I hope the people would reach out to us to find out some more of our services here at the center. And again, they can use that number 943-2412 because telecare is important to people that are shut in. And liquid nutrition is important to some people. But those are other services that we have, plus transportation. We have a great transportation system here.
Wow. Well, we still have a few more minutes left to talk about that. I think if we want to get into that.
I think one of the things that, because of the people being shut in so much, our numbers for telecare people were down. Maybe we only had two or three people that we were contacting. But we've got probably maybe 8 or 10 now, and the numbers are going up for some people that are lonely. They just want to talk to somebody. So we do offer that service, and that you would call again to that 943-2412 number and register. And if you want to be called every day, someone call you every day. We don't want to do it between probably like, say 9 a.m. till maybe 2 at the latest, just to make sure that someone is safe. If we don't get an answer and we have an alternate number to call, we do that. If we still don't get an answer, we send a well check by the police to make sure that that person has not fallen or they're having some other difficulty. And we have to have to do that before. With Meals on Wheels people as well as telecare people. So those are two great services. And our transportation department, mostly it's the priority is medical for people that may be on dialysis. They have priority. But the price is $1 per person each way. And you can schedule an appointment. They have hours here between 9 a.m. and 1 where someone would be the dispatcher that would do the scheduling so that you could get a ride. And then they have to call a different number for that. That's our transportation department. And that's area code 313-943-4083. And they would talk with you about the transportation. I'm not in that department, but I'm very well aware of it. It's right across from our office. So I think the other thing I mentioned was liquid nutrition. And that's available once a month, but that's by a doctor's prescription only. And I have probably between 35 to 40 people that are registered for that come in monthly to pick up the liquid nutrition, and that's through the Wayne County also. And they get two cases, which we be 48 bottles of the insurer.
Thanks so much for that. And that's a lot of phone numbers, a lot of different services, a lot of different contact points for people in the community who may need some of that support. The central number, I'd imagine, 313-943-2412 is probably, or again, for people, cityofdearborn.org. For people in the city of Dearborn, you can always call City Hall, I'd imagine, and they'd find a way to get you in touch with the correct people and the services that you need.
Yeah, I would use the 943-2412 number for sure, because, you know, we'll direct you, you know, if you're looking to sign up for Meals on Wheels, we'll direct a person to the right number and probably answer some questions for them also.
Sounds terrific. Well, CC Pilon, we are grateful for your time, your efforts, and your encouragement of others to see what they can do to find some time to contribute to our community in a very wonderful and caring way. You are certainly doing that on a regular basis. So I'm glad the city had the wherewithal to hire you after volunteering for 5 years. Sounds like it's your calling. And we are grateful for you being in this position. We wish you happy Thanksgiving season, of course, and I hope all the things you said you wish for Thanksgiving do come true. I think we all echo in that sentiment, and we are very grateful for your time today.
Oh, thank you. And I'm happy to be here, very happy. Thank you.
This is the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek, along with Susan McGraw, CC Pilon. Thank you so much for being with us on the program today. We have had a great conversation and hopefully shed a spotlight on some of the services that are available in the community and ways that you and your office and everybody that is connected in your universe can be of assistance to people who need that help. So it's been great to talk to you.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more in just a moment here on WHFR Making Waves.
If you think or know you had COVID-19, you can be around others after 10 days since symptoms first appeared and after 24 hours with no fever without fever-reducing medication and after other symptoms have improved. If you have tested positive for COVID-19 and you had no symptoms, you can be around others 10 days after you got tested for COVID-19. To learn more, visit cdc.gov/coronavirus.
My name is Lola Silvestri, and I'm going to be 95 this year. I was very independent. I fell, and I had to have Meals on Wheels. America, let's do lunch.
One in six seniors faces the threat of hunger, and millions more live in isolation. Drop off a hot meal and say a quick hello. Volunteer for Meals on Wheels by donating your lunch break at americaletsdolunch.org. This message brought to you by Meals on Wheels America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. This is the WHFR Journal. My name is Alan Mazurek. Pleased to be with you this Friday afternoon here on WHFR Making Waves. As we, almost semi-officially head into holiday season. We know what holiday is next week, of course. And let's see. We've got, just to get us in the spirit for next week, we want to bring you a program called My Life as a Wild Turkey. Well, apologies to our vegetarian and vegan friends, but as we know, this next week is all about the bird. And on our program today, we're going to hear world-renowned naturalist Joe Hutto, subject of the Emmy-winning BBC documentary My Life as a Turkey, discussing how he became a wild turkey mother in the hammocks of Florida. We'll also hear from fourth-generation pilot Eric Walden giving us a play-by-play of wild turkey in the air, and talk about how the bronze feathered turkey is making a comeback with the help of organic free-range farmers like Paul Kelly. So let's listen to it now from our friends at With Good Reason here on the WHFR Journal. Let's enjoy our lives, our lives as a wild turkey. My Life as a Wild Turkey from With Good Reason here on the WHFR Journal.
It's that time of year when Turkey Day is approaching. Construction paper turkeys grace classroom walls. Thanksgiving menus are being meticulously planned, and children of all ages are making the trek back home. I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, we delve into the myths and truths of the wild turkey. We even talk with an extraordinary man who learned to be a turkey mother.
Day after day, for over a year, I saw no one except my family. It was a family like none that you know. But I'm a mother, it seems, and these are my children. And soon enough, like all children, they'll leave home, and I suppose my heart will be broken. But for now, this is my life as a turkey.
We'll talk with Joe Hutto in a moment. But first, some myth-busting. There's a story Benjamin Franklin wanted the national bird to be the turkey rather than the bald eagle. While that's not true, it is true that Franklin called the bald eagle a bird of bad moral character, and he admired the wild turkey for being, as he wrote to his daughter, a much more respectable bird and withal a true original native of America. Another turkey myth is that the bird can't fly. It's true that domestic turkeys are too heavy to fly, but wild turkeys can fly up to 55 miles per hour. With Good Reason producer Allison Quantz reports that even pilots have an appreciation for turkey flight.
If you've ever stopped to watch a hawk wheel and turn through the sky, you can imagine that pilots might find inspiration in birds. Captain Eric Walden is a fourth-generation pilot, and there's one bird that he's taken note of.
It's very difficult to find them, especially when you're looking for them. And you can stalk around in the woods and fields all day long and never find a single one.
Walden is talking, of course, about wild turkeys.
The flying part is always stunning because you think there's no way these animals are going to fly away, and the whole flock will take flight in the middle of a dense forest and disappear.
A wild turkey can weigh over 20 pounds. That's about as heavy as a car tire.
You'd imagine the legs that can move something like that at high speed and with a high level of agility. They don't just run in a straight line, but they jink and turn and leap over obstacles and move very fast while they're doing it. The size of the legs, if you've ever been to a county fair or something like that, you have turkey legs for sale, and the thing looks like it came off a dinosaur. You know, it's 18 inches long and 6 inches around and weighs, 5 pounds. So those are the legs.
And those big, chunky legs make sense, because turkeys spend most of their lives on the ground. But sometimes they have to fly in order to live.
Flying is a tool that they use to escape and move short distances.
It's that moment of transition from ground to air that Walden finds particularly remarkable. And I'm going to let him take it from here. So close your eyes, put yourself in the middle of a field or forest, and imagine a car tire sprouting wings.
These big fat wings come out of the side of the body and just start pummeling the ground. Grass and leaves and branches flying all over the place, and they're all doing it simultaneously. And then somebody trips and has to get up. They're in this dash to reach flight velocity, but the first several beats of the wings, they're grasping at the air. So it looks like they're barely going to make it. And as a pilot, I can relate to that. The first few moments after liftoff, you're the most exposed. You're close to the ground, you're at low speed, you have very few options. So if the turkey at this point comes across an obstacle it can't clear, there's going to be a crash. But the legs tuck into the body, and all of a sudden, he's transformed into an aerial ninja. They can fly through a tight forest on a steep hill in between trees, either turning sideways, knife edge, or actually tucking their wings together and shooting in between two trees like a feathered missile. And on the other side, unfurling those big fat wings to execute a 90-degree turn, probably pulling as many G's as an F-22 fighter pilot in an aggressive maneuver. Using those legs so they can bounce off of trees, bounce off of the ground, do like a half flight, half running dance, I suppose. But it's not really a dance because it looks ridiculous. The transition from flight to ground is as unceremonious. They don't come in and flutter and alight softly upon the ground. They basically pick a spot, they crash to the ground, sliding through the grass and the leaves. But they hop right back up. They're tough birds. And they pop those periscope necks up and take a look around, and if everything looks good to go, then they just go back to being a ground-based bird.
For With Good Reason, I'm Allison Quantz.
Coming up next, contrary to popular belief, wild turkeys are intelligent, and they're born with an incredible genetic blueprint of their natural world. My next guest is Joe Hutto. He lived for 2 years raising a rafter of wild turkeys who all thought he was their mother. He also spent 9 years living with a herd of mule deer and becoming an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker along the way. Joe Hutto is a wildlife artist, ethologist, and author. Joe, you wrote and illustrated the incredible book, Illumination in the Flatwoods, which was later turned into My Life as a Turkey. It's about the 2 years you spent as a turkey mother. How'd you get to be a turkey mother?
Well, I got the eggs. Turkey hens, when they're sitting on their nest, they actually talk to their eggs. And so I actually did that. I would try to talk to the eggs and turkey. I understood a little wild turkey vocabulary. And so I'd make little turkey-like sounds, and it was amazing. When they hatched, they absolutely knew who I was.
Can you give me a little bit of turkey sound?
No.
I mean, you can't.
Absolutely not. No. No, I'm not going on radio and television and make turkey noises. Yeah. You know, the truth is that I got very good at that.
Yeah.
But it's almost like learning a foreign language, and I haven't spoken wild turkey, as silly as that sounds, in quite a few years, and so I've almost lost the capacity to do it.
You didn't just get handed eggs. You'd wanted them for a long time, right?
That's right. I just had this opportunity. Somebody brought me two clutches of these wild turkey eggs that the nests had been destroyed by tractors mowing through the woods. And I said, okay, I'm going to do this. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Young people who have seen that movie are so inspired by your experience and ask you, how did you do it? What do you say to them?
I get asked this question a lot, you know, how do I do what you do? And it's very difficult. When I was in college, you couldn't study ethology. That's what I do. I'm an ethologist. And what that is a person who studies animal behavior in a natural setting. I don't use cages or any type of enclosure. And so my objective is to observe animal behavior and intelligence and consciousness in its most natural form. And up until very recently, that was not an area of academics that a person could go into. And now that's changing in biology. But when I was in college, if you wanted to study animal behavior, you went into behavioral psychology and studied rudimentary Pavlovian concepts having to do with stimulus and response and habituation. And it really didn't lend much insight into true animal behavior and consciousness.
Did you experience joy and the sort of sense of love and protection when these little turkeys hatched?
Absolutely. It's like being around any newborn animal. You know, I think biologically we're predisposed to have a parental response to a young animal. And it's precisely that response that I think lends the most insight to an observer, that you actually fall in love with these little creatures like a parent. And as a result, your interest becomes almost obsessive. And if you've observed a new mother with a child, you notice that she almost can't take her eyes off that creature. And that's the way it is with a young animal that you've imprinted. You have this incredible fascination and empathy. And every little subtle nuance is suddenly very fascinating.
From watching My Life as a Turkey, it seemed that your turkeys were so smart, and yet all my life people have said turkeys are stupid.
Well, that's a sad thing, and you know, they've bred the domestic turkey to almost pathetic, grotesque creatures. And wild turkeys are very, very different, and they are incredibly intelligent and very sensitive. And they're social creatures, and they have this ability to relate and to learn. You know, I use the word consciousness a lot in my research because that's essentially what I study is not just animal intelligence, but their consciousness, you know, their experience of the world and their experience of you and their ability to learn how the universe works around them.
You have said that you think it is selfish and arrogant for the human species to think that we alone possess that kind of consciousness, and that you, in fact, saw this in your turkeys.
We have no privileged access to reality. Consciousness is almost biologically mandated. You know, you have to have this conscious will to survive, and that's its razor's edge. Consciousness is being awake on the planet, just being awake. And while creatures, out of absolute necessity, have to be totally awake, totally alert, they have to be ready. They have to be actually willing to think about things. All creatures, out of absolute necessity, have to experience some level of consciousness just to maintain their existence.
You've even said that the wild turkeys you lived with had problem-solving intelligence. How so?
Well, they were far more intelligent than me, in a sense.
Yeah.
They understood, almost without exception, every plant and every animal, and the specificity of that knowledge was stunning. They knew every insect. They knew if it was edible. They knew if it was dangerous. And so not only did they know these plants and these animals, but in many cases they had specific vocalizations to describe these. And so I would hear a certain vocalization from a turkey or several turkeys, and I would know without question not only had they found a snake, but I would know exactly what species of snake they had found. And so I would walk right past a large diamondback rattlesnake coiled in some blackberries, and the turkeys would immediately notify me that I had done something really stupid.
Is it true that wild turkeys can't be bred in captivity?
It is. Wild turkeys were almost hunted into extinction in the turn of the last century and during the Depression, you know, where there were subsistence hunters, and then there were a lot of desperate people, and they almost disappeared from the landscape.
What brought them back?
Law enforcement brought them back. States realized, federal government realized that these animals were going to have to be regulated. And so we had hunting seasons, and, you know, and that's true with many species. You know, white-tailed deer were almost hunted into extinction. For the most part, wild turkeys are very abundant, but it's principally because of wildlife management and that consciousness that it has to be regulated.
So how did you mother your turkeys and raise them in the wild?
My main concern was keeping them alive at night. First light in the morning, they would immediately fly down to me, and I would take them out of the cage as the sun was coming up or as it was getting light, and we would stay out all day. And then we would come in right before dark, and we would enter the cage. They would follow me in. They would fly up on their little roosting limbs, and after it got completely dark, I would literally have to sneak out of the cage so that they wouldn't fly down to the ground and try to follow me.
I remember nights like that as a mother.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. You just do what you have to do.
Right. And, of course, as with any parent, you experienced as the mother of these turkeys just how distinctive their personalities were from the get-go. Let me play this excerpt from your film where you talk about two of your turkeys that you were very fond of, one named Turkey Boy and the other one Sweet Pea.
I now know each of the birds by their character and personality as much as by their appearance. Turkey Boy is still up to his old tricks. He's always pushing his brothers and sisters around, but no one seems to mind too much. Sweet Pea still has this need for closeness. She stares motionless at me for what seems like a very long time, and it's obviously a conscious behavior. It's as though she's trying to absorb something. Being the object of such intense scrutiny by such a little thing is a very strange sensation. Turkey Boy and I were, we couldn't have been closer, and we couldn't have had a a closer relationship.
I can't remember. Did you let him be dominant?
I did. I didn't have the right body language because I'm not really a turkey, and I don't really speak loud turkey vocabulary.
Did turkey mothering make you swear off turkeys for Thanksgiving as a food?
Well, you know, I've gone through this incredible sort of personal evolution from being, I grew up in a hunting culture.
Yeah.
And I grew up with people that had a history of subsistence hunting. So when I was a child and a young person, I was a turkey hunter. You know, as the Rose said, you know, you go thither at first as a hunter or fisher, and till at last you find the seeds of a higher life, and go forth as a poet or naturalist he may be, and leave the gun and fish pole behind. And I'm sort of paraphrasing there, but anyway, that was sort of my development.
Now you are wrapping up your life with the mule deer of Wyoming.
Mm-hmm.
9 winters with mule deer, is that right?
It's hard to believe, but yes, I have. I've spent 9 years with mule deer, literally almost without exception, every day for 9 years I've been with these animals. And the more I watch, the more incredibly complex they become.
When you're living among the mule deer, do you have to cope with hunters during hunting season in Wyoming?
Well, of course. It's a very difficult thing that I have to navigate through because I become, of course, very attached to these sensitive, intelligent, affectionate creatures that I have intimate relationships with. You know, I've known these deer since in many cases since the day they were born, and I know them for 7, 8, 9 years in some cases. I've lost deer, you know, in the last few years that I grieve over. You know, I think about them constantly, and I miss them.
You had an awful encounter with one of your more beloved mule deer, where you were accidentally gored.
I did. I had an unfortunate encounter with a mule deer just 2-3 nights ago. One of these bigger bucks, he's probably 6-7 years old. I've known him since he was a spotted fawn. He's just a real good friend of mine, if I could put it that way. We have a very close relationship. I would trust him with my life. In fact, I do every day. Well, he got his antler caught in my sleeve of my shirt.
Mm.
And he just panicked and exploded. And I got gored really bad in inside of my elbow. And about a 4 or 5 inch gash. And probably nicked a little artery in there. And, of course, I'm standing there bleeding. And he was far more upset than I was because he knew that it hurt me, but he didn't understand what had happened. And so I spent probably 15 or 20 minutes trying to convince him that he hadn't done anything wrong. He was kind of pitiful. He was so upset.
Oh, my gosh. You could tell he was upset at injuring you.
Oh, he absolutely could not understand why we had had some sort of negative encounter. And I'm standing there bleeding almost profusely and trying to assure this 300-pound buck that he did not do anything wrong, and that everything was fine, and that we were still buddies. And after about 15 or 20 minutes, he relaxed, and his ears dropped down, and his eyes softened, and he very, very slowly walked back up to me. He was almost contrite.
Are you going to be okay?
I'm fine, sure. Yeah, I've got a big hole in my arm, but yeah, I'm just fine.
I'm so grateful for the work that you've done.
Oh, thank you.
And it revolutionizes our understanding of fellow creatures.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Joe Hutto is a naturalist, author, and Emmy Award-winning filmmaker. His most recent book is The Light in High Places. A naturalist looks at Wyoming wilderness, Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep, cowboys, and other rare species. Here's some turkey trivia. Did you know the turkeys we buy at the grocery store are all the white-feathered kind? It's strange because if you Google turkey, what comes up are pictures of those dark-feathered turkeys that we all drew pictures of in grade school. So how did we come to eat only white turkeys? With good reason, assistant producer Lilia Fuchin traveled to a free-range turkey farm where she learned how the so-called bronze turkey went out of fashion decades ago.
Here in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Central Virginia, I've come to visit an organic turkey farmer.
A female turkey goes, and a male turkey goes, it's only the male turkeys that gobble, not the female turkeys.
This is Paul Kelly, the British owner of this 100-acre farm that's now the first North American branch of the Kelly Bronze Company. And Judd Culver is the local farmer here.
Hey, gobble, gobble, gobble. Hey.
These guys love turkeys. And this farm is unique because they're raising free-range bronze turkeys. Bronze turkeys are the dark-feathered birds we usually associate with turkey. And even though these were brought here from Britain, they're actually native to the Americas.
Every turkey in the world originally was bronze in feather. It came from Mexico. It's the old, slow-growing bronze breed.
The Kelly Bronze motto is bred to be wild. So these turkeys live in the great outdoors. They roost in trees at night, and they can fly.
They normally like to run before they fly, because they are kind of big and bulky, right? So if a predator comes, they will take off running. And then if they have to, then they'll fly.
So why is a British guy bringing the bronze turkey back to the U.S.? Paul explains that it's because the bronze turkey has pretty much disappeared from the market. And this started back in the 1950s. As a result of factory farming, people were getting more and more removed from their food sources. And they started to get really turned off by these little pin feathers that were left in the turkey's skin after plucking.
The whole reason the bronze turkey disappeared back in the 1950s was because of the little black feather stub in the skin.
And grocery stores wanted a cleaner look for their customers.
That bronze feather seemed to be unsightly, and the up-and-coming supermarkets wanted a really nice pearly white skin for the plastic bags. Frozen was fashionable, and the bronze turkey literally went out of fashion all in the space of 5 or 6 years, purely for aesthetics.
It turns out the white turkeys people have been buying in grocery stores for the past 60 years have the very same pin feathers. They're just harder to see.
The white turkey's got exactly the same amount of feather quills, but of course it's a white pigment. You don't see it.
Do we end up eating those?
You do.
We do.
But when you're eating a white turkey, you're eating them anyway. It's good protein. Look at it that way. We call it designer stubble. That's what we call it.
In 1971, Paul's father was disillusioned with the industrial poultry business, and the bronze turkeys were practically becoming extinct. So it was a radical move when Paul's parents started raising bronze turkeys. Like heirloom vegetables and flowers, these turkeys are from a pretty old, sturdy genetic stock. But that's not the only thing that's different about this Kelly Bronze turkey farm. They hand process each turkey by dry plucking them and then aging the birds before Thanksgiving customers come to pick them up.
In England, we call it New York dressed. We're dry plucking them by hand and hanging them, as you would a pheasant. Turkey's a game bird and it should be hung, before preparing it for the oven. It's nothing new. What we're doing, actually, is very, very old. It's nothing new at all. It's just tradition to the extreme.
Judd says that another important factor is timing. They let the turkeys reach sexual maturity before harvesting, rather than harvesting them at a certain weight.
We grow these guys, sexual maturity, they have tons of fat. I mean, sexual maturity, like any animal, is when you start to get fat, right? So, it's part of the profile.
Because our birds are so mature, there's all the fat marbling running through the meat, and fat conducts the heat through the muscle tissue quicker. So it will cook in twice the time.
When it comes to cooking the turkey, Paul has one word of advice.
Please don't brine it. Just plain roast it, 2 to 2.5 hours, and you'll have an amazing Thanksgiving feast.
For more information on the Bred to be Wild Kelly Bronze Turkey Farm in Greenwood, Virginia, go to kellyturkeys.co.uk. Wow. For With Good Reason, I'm Lilia Fuchin. You make everything
wild. Next up for you, a poetic send-off.
Wild thing.
College students everywhere are packing up and heading home for Thanksgiving. But before his class is dismissed, one professor likes to entertain his students with a poem he writes especially for them. Here is mechanical engineering professor Jay Sullivan of Virginia Military Institute reading a Thanksgiving tale about one of his students who tried to invent a new turkey cooking device.
One Thanksgiving furlough comes, cadets of all types scatter, to visit home and family and get a little fatter. Some years ago, one cadet who studied engineering went home with all his books and notes, a trait I find endearing. When the day of feasting came, he took his mom aside and told her, "Let me use my craft to cook the bird outside. I'll build a fine rotisserie with my engineering skill, and then I'll even patent it, the exothermic poultry turning mill." He set to work without a pause and cut a shaft of steel, onto which he added some bearings and a wheel. Next, he took a fan belt from his brother's girlfriend's car and joined the engine to the shaft in a manner most bizarre. The turkey then was mounted upon his great machine with snap rings at the fore and aft and roll pins in between. A charcoal fire was set beneath and all systems were go as the turkey started cooking from the charcoal's orangey glow. Our cadet then flipped a switch to start the engine turning and threw the fan belt to the shaft to keep the bird from burning. Oh dear, what happened next, I say? My poor old heart beseeching. Was it engineering in youth's hands simply overreaching? Or maybe worse yet still, the wreckage of my earnest teaching? You see, my cadet, his name withheld for reputation, had neglected the effects of mass coupled with gyration. The turkey, being rather large when brought up to full speed, ripped apart quite handily at 37 G's. Turkey parts were scattered wide, and no one got to eating, as everyone was full of ire and words not for repeating. My cadet recovered, his self-esteem intact, and now he's a consultant making thousands at a crack. So what's the moral of this tale? I really couldn't say. Let's end it now, and off you go. Enjoy Thanksgiving Day.
There you go.
There you go.
That's a fond poetic salute goodbye from Professor Jay Sullivan, who teaches mechanical engineering to students at Virginia Military Institute. Major support for With Good Reason is provided by an anonymous donor, the law firm of McGuire Woods, and by the University of Virginia Health System, a National Cancer Institute-designated cancer center researching and developing the treatments of tomorrow, uvahealth.com. With Good Reason is produced by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Elliot Majerzik and Allison Quantz are our associate producers. Our assistant producer is Lilia Fukin. Andrew Windham is our executive producer. Jeannie Palin handles listener services, and Miranda Bennett is our intern. Special thanks this week to Kelly Frank. Visit us at withgoodreasonradio.org or download the podcast on iTunes. You can reach us at 434-243-5521. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the WHFR Journal. My name is Alan Mazurek. It's been a pleasure to be with you this Friday afternoon. We do hope you have a great weekend. A happy Thanksgiving. We'll be back next Friday with more on the WHFR Journal here on the station Making Waves. At 89.3 and online at WHFR.FM, this is WHFR Dearborn. Stay tuned. Katie Love taking us on a blues trip down Highway 61 coming up now.
The longest highway that I know.